And then, after all these shocks on Earth and in heaven, there was the business of the one little graveyard right here on Jenny. But even that didn't seem to count much for Maddie because, after all, she had not been there. With the end of civilization now clearly at hand and the island cut off, thankfully cut off, in the opinion of the residents, from the rest of the world, old ways had reasserted themselves with unspoken but inarguable force. By then, they all knew what was going to happen. It was only a question of when, that, and being ready when it did. Women were excluded. It was Bob Daggett, of course, who drew up the watch roster. That was only right, since Bob had been head selectman on Jenny for about 1,000 years. The day after the death of the president, the thought of him and the First Lady wandering witlessly through the streets of Washington, D.C., gnawing on human arms and legs like people eating chicken legs at a picnic, was not mentioned. It was a little much to bear, even if the bastard and his blonde wife were Democrats. Bob Daggett called the first men-only town meeting on Jenny since sometime before the Civil War. Maddie wasn't there, but she heard. Dave Emmons told her all she needed to know. "You men all know the situation," Bob said. He looked as yellow as a man with jaundice, and people remembered his daughter, the one still living at home on the island, was only one of four. The other three were other places, which was to say, on the mainland. But hell, if it came down to that, they all had folks on the mainland. "We got one boneyard here on Jenny," Bob continued, "and nothing ain't happened there yet, but that don't mean nothing will. Nothing ain't happened yet in lots of places, but it seems like once it starts, nothing turns to something pretty goddamn quick." There was a rumble of assent from the men gathered in the grammar school gymnasium, which was the only place big enough to hold them. There were about 70 of them in all, ranging in age from Johnny Crane, who had just turned 18, to Bob's great-uncle Frank, who was 80, had a glass eye, and chewed tobacco. There was no spittoon in the gym, of course, so Frank Daggett had brought an empty mayonnaise jar to spit his juice into. He did so now. "Get down to where the cheese binds, Bobby," he said. "You ain't got no office to run for, and time's a-wastin'." There was another rumble of agreement, and Bob Daggett flushed. Somehow, his great-uncle always managed to make him look like an ineffectual fool, and if there was anything in the world he hated worse than looking like an ineffectual fool, it was being called Bobby. He owned property, for Christ's sakes, and he supported the old fart, bought him his goddamn chew. But these were not things he could say. Old Frank's eyes were like pieces of flint. "Okay," Bob said curtly. "Here it is. We want 12 men to a watch. I'm going to set a roster in just a couple of minutes. 4-hour shifts." "I can stand watch a hell of a lot longer than 4 hours," Matt Arsenault spoke up. And Davy told Maddie that Bob said after the meeting that no welfare slacker like Matt Arsenault would have had the nerve to speak up like that in a meeting of his betters if that old man hadn't called him Bobby, like he was a kid, instead of a man 3 months shy of his 50th birthday in front of all the island men. "Maybe you can, maybe you can't," Bob said, "but we got plenty of warm bodies and nobody's going to fall asleep on sentry duty." "I ain't gonna. I didn't say you," Bob said, but the way his eyes rested on Matt Arsenault suggested that he might have meant him. "This is no kid's game. Sit down, shut up." Matt Arsenault opened his mouth to say something more, then looked around at the other men, including old Frank Daggett, and wisely held his peace. "If you got a rifle, bring it when it's your trick," Bob continued. He felt a little better with Arsenault more or less back in his place. "Unless it's a .22, that is. If you ain't got something bigger than that, come and get one here." "I didn't know the school kept a supply of 'em handy," Cal Partridge said, and there was a ripple of laughter. "It don't now, but it will," Bob said, "because every man jack of you with more'n one rifle bigger than a .22 is going to bring it here." He looked at John Worley, the school principal. "Okay if we keep 'em in your office, John?" Worley nodded. Beside him, Reverend Johnson was dry washing his hands in a distraught way. "Shit on that," Orrin Campbell said. "I got a wife and 2 kids at home. Am I supposed to leave 'em with nothing to defend themselves with if a bunch of cops has come for an early Thanksgiving dinner while I'm on watch?" "If we do our job at the boneyard, none will," Bob replied stonily. "Some of you got handguns. We don't want none of those. Figure out which women can shoot and which can't, and give 'em the pistols. We'll put 'em together in bunches." "They can play Beano," old Frank cackled, and Bob smiled too. That was more like it, by the Christ. Nights. "We're going to want trucks posted around so we got plenty of light." He looked over at Sonny Dotson, who ran Island Amoco, the only gas station on Jenny. Sonny's main business wasn't gassing cars and trucks. Shit, there was no place much on the island to drive, and you could get your go 10 cents cheaper on the mainland. but filling up lobster boats in the motorboats he ran out of his Jack Lake Marina in the summer. "You gonna supply the gas, Sonny?" "Am I gonna get cash slips?" "You're gonna get your ass saved," Bob said. "When things get back to normal, if they ever do, I guess you'll get what you got coming." Sonny looked around, saw only hard eyes, and shrugged. He looked a bit sullen, but in truth, he looked more confused than anything, Davy told Maddie the next day. "Ain't got no more than 400 gallons of gas," he said. "Mostly diesel." "There's 5 generators on the island," Bert Dorfman said. When Bert spoke, everyone listened. As the only Jew on the island, he was regarded as a creature both quixotic and fearsome, like an oracle that works about half the time. "They all run on diesel. I can rig lights if I have to." Low murmurs. If Bert said he could do it, he could. He was a Jewish electrician, and there was a feeling on the outer islands, unarticulated but powerful, that that was the best kind. "We're going to light that graveyard up like a friggin' stage," Bob said. Andy Kingsbury stood up. "I heard on the news that sometimes you can shoot one of those things in the head and it'll stay down, sometimes it won't." "We got chainsaws," Bob said stonily, "and what won't stay dead, why, we can make sure it won't move too far alive." And, except for making out the duty roster, that was pretty much that. Six days and nights passed, and the sentries posted around the little graveyard on Jenny were starting to feel a wee bit silly. "I don't know if I'm standing guard or pulling my pud," Orrin Campbell said one afternoon, as a dozen men stood around the cemetery gate playing liar's poker. When it happened, it happened fast. Dave told Maddie that he heard a sound like the wind wailing in the chimney on a gusty night, and then the gravestone marking the final resting place of Mr. and Mrs. Fournier's boy, Michael, who had died of leukemia at 17. Bad go, that had been, him being their only child and them being such nice people and all, fell over. A moment later, a shredded hand with a moss-caked Yarmouth Academy class ring on one finger rose out of the ground, shoving through the tough grass. The third finger had been torn off in the process. The ground heaved like the belly of a pregnant woman getting ready to drop her load, Dave almost said and hastily reconsidered. Like a big wave rolling into a close cove. And then the boy himself sat up, only he wasn't anything you could really recognize, not after almost 2 years in the ground. There were little splinters of wood sticking out of what was left of his face, Davy said, and pieces of shiny blue cloth in the draggles of his hair. "That was coffin lining," Davy told her, looking down at his restlessly twining hands. "I know that as well as I know my own name." He paused, then added, "Thank Christ Mike's dad didn't have that trick." Maddie had nodded. The men on guard, bullshit scared as well as revolted, opened fire on the reanimated corpse of the former high school chess champion and all-star second baseman, tearing him to shreds. Other shots, fired in wild panic, blew chips off his marble gravestone, and it was just luck that the armed men had been loosely grouped together when the festivities commenced. If they had been divided up into 2 wings, as Bob Daggett had originally intended, they would very likely have slaughtered each other. As it was, not a single islander was hurt, although Bud Meacham found a rather suspicious-looking hole torn in the sleeve of his shirt the next day. "Probably want nothing but a blackberry thorn just the same," he said. "There's an almighty lot of 'em out that end of the island, you know." No one would dispute that, but the black smudges around the hole made his frightened wife think that his shirt had been torn by a thorn with a pretty large caliber. The Fournier kid fell back, most of him lying still, other parts of him still twitching. But by then the whole graveyard seemed to be rippling, as if an earthquake were going on there, but only there, no place else. Just about an hour before dusk, this had happened. Bert Dorfman had rigged up a siren to a tractor battery, and Bob Daggett flipped the switch. Within 20 minutes, most of the men in town were at the island cemetery. "Goddamn good thing, too," Dave Eamon said, because a few of the debtors almost got away. Old Frank Daggett, still 2 hours from the heart attack that would carry him off just as the excitement was dying down, organized the new men so they wouldn't shoot each other either, and for the final 10 minutes the Jenny Boneyard sounded like Bull Run. By the end of the festivities, the powder smoke was so thick that some of the men choked on it. The sour smell of vomit was almost heavier than the smell of gun smoke. It was sharper, too, and lingered longer. And still, some of them wriggled and squirmed like snakes with broken backs, the fresher ones for the most part. Bert, Frank Daggett said. You got them chainsaws? I got them, Bert said, and then a long, buzzing sound came out of his mouth, a sound like a cicada burrowing its way into tree bark as he dry-heaved. He could not take his eyes from the squirming corpses, the overturned gravestones, the yawning pits from which the dead had come. In the truck. Gassed up? Blue veins stood out on Frank's ancient hairless skull. Yeah. Bert's hand was over his mouth. I'm sorry. Work your fucking gut all you want, Frank said briskly, but toddle off and get them saws while you do. And you. The last you was his grandnephew Bob. I can't, Uncle Frank, Bob said sickly. He looked around and saw five or six of his friends and neighbors lying crumpled in the tall grass. They had not died. They had swooned. Most of them had seen their own relatives rise out of the ground. Buck Harkness, over there lying by an aspen tree, had been part of the crossfire that had cut his late wife to ribbons. He had fainted after observing her decayed, worm-riddled brains exploding from the back of her head in a grisly gray splash. I can't. I can't. Frank's hand, twisted with arthritis, but as hard as stone, cracked across his face. You can and you will, chummy, he said. Bob went with the rest of the men. Frank Daggett watched them grimly and rubbed his chest, which had begun to send cramped throbs of pain all the way down his left arm to his elbow. He was old, but he wasn't stupid, and he had a pretty good idea what those pains were and what they meant. He told me he thought he was going to have a blowout, and he tapped his chest when he said it, Dave went on, and placed his hand on the swell of muscle over his own left nipple to demonstrate. Maddie nodded to show she understood. He said, if anything happens to me before this mess is cleaned up, Davy, you and Bert and Orrin take over. Bobby's a good boy, but I think he may have lost his guts for at least a little while, and you know, sometimes when a man loses his guts, they don't come back. Maddie nodded again, thinking how grateful she was, how very, very grateful that she was not a man. So, then we did it, Dave said. We cleaned up the mess. Maddie nodded a third time, but this time she must have made some sound because Dave told her he would stop if she couldn't bear it. He would gladly stop. I can bear it, she said quietly. You might be surprised how much I can bear, Davy. He looked at her quickly, curiously, when she said that, but Maddie had averted her eyes before he could see the secret in them. Dave didn't know the secret because no one on Jenny knew. That was the way Maddie wanted it, and the way she intended to keep it. There had been a time when she had, perhaps, in the blue darkness of her shock, pretended to be coping, and then something happened that made her cope. 4 days before the island cemetery vomited up its corpses, Maddie Pace was faced with a simple choice, cope or die. She had been sitting in the living room, drinking a glass of the blueberry wine she and Jack had put up during August of the previous year, a time that now seemed impossibly distant, and doing something so trite it was laughable. She was knitting little things. Booties, in fact. But what else was there to do? It seemed that no one would be going across the reach to the Wee Folks store at the Ellsworth Mall for quite some time. Something had thumped against the window. A bat, she thought, looking up. Her needles paused in her hands, though. It seemed that something bigger had moved jerkily out there in the windy dark. The oil lamp was turned up high and kicking too much reflection off the panes for her to be sure. She reached to turn it down, and the thump came again. The panes shivered. She heard a little pattering of dried putty falling on the sash. Jack had been planning to reglaze all the windows this fall, she remembered, and then thought, maybe that's what he came back for. That was crazy. He was on the bottom of the ocean, but... She sat with her head cocked to one side, her knitting now motionless in her hands. A little pink booty. She had already made a blue set. All of a sudden, it seemed, she could hear so much. The wind. The faint thunder of surf on Cricket Ledge. The house making little groaning sounds like an elderly woman making herself comfortable in bed. The tick of the clock in the hallway. Jack? She asked the silent night that was now no longer silent. Is it you, dear? Then the living room window burst inward, and what came through was not really Jack, but a skeleton with a few moldering strings of flesh hanging from it. His compass was still around his neck. It had grown a beard of moss. The wind flapped the curtains in a cloud above him as he sprawled, then got up on his hands and knees and looked at her from black sockets in which barnacles had grown. He made grunting sounds. His fleshless mouth opened and the teeth chomped down. He was hungry, but this time chicken noodle soup would not serve, not even the kind that came in the can. Gray stuff hung and swung beyond those dark, barnacle-encrusted holes, and she realized she was looking at whatever remained of Jack's brain. She sat where she was, frozen, as he got up and came toward her, leaving black, kelpy tracks on the carpet, fingers reaching. He stank of salt and fathoms. His hands stretched. His teeth chomped mechanically up and down. Maddie saw he was wearing the remains of the black and red checked shirt she had bought him at L.L. Bean's last Christmas. It had cost the earth, but he had said again and again how warm it was, and look how well it had lasted, how much of it was left, even after being underwater all this time. The cold cobwebs of bone, which were all that remained of his fingers, touched her throat before the baby kicked in her stomach for the first time, and her shocked horror, which she had believed to be calmness, fled, and she drove one of the knitting needles into the thing's eye. Making horrid, thick, choking noises that sounded like the suck of a swill pump, he staggered backward, clawing at the needle, while the half-made pink booty swung in front of the cavity where his nose had been. She watched as a sea slug squirmed from that nasal cavity and onto the booty, leaving a trail of slime behind it. Jack fell over the end table she'd gotten at a yard sale just after they had been married. She hadn't been able to make her mind up about it, had been in agonies about it, until Jack finally said either she was going to buy it for their living room or he was going to give the biddy running the sale twice what she was asking for the goddamn thing and then bust it up for firewood He struck the floor, and there was a brittle, cracking sound as his febrile, fragile form broke in two. The right hand tore the knitting needle, slimed with decaying brain tissue, from his eye socket and tossed it aside. His top half crawled toward her, his teeth gnashed steadily together. She thought he was trying to grin, and then the baby kicked again, and she remembered how uncharacteristically tired and out of sorts he'd sounded at Mabel Hanratty's yard sale that day. "Buy it, Maddie, for Christ's sakes, I'm tired. Want to go home and get my dinner. If you don't get a move on, I'll give the old bat twice what she wants and bust it up for firewood with my..." Cold, dank hand clutching her ankle, polluted teeth poised to bite, to kill her and kill the baby. She tore loose, leaving him with only her slipper, which he chewed on and then spat out. When she came back from the entry, he was crawling mindlessly into the kitchen, at least the top half of him was, with the compass dragging on the tiles. He looked up at the sound of her, and there seemed to be some idiot question in those black eye sockets before she brought the axe whistling down, cleaving his skull as he had threatened to cleave the end table. His head fell in two pieces, brains dribbling across the tile like spoiled oatmeal, brains that squirmed with slugs and gelatinous sea worms, brains that smelled like a woodchuck exploded with gassy decay in a high summer meadow. Still, his hands clashed and clittered on the kitchen tiles, making a sound like beetles. She chopped, chopped, chopped. At last, there was no more movement. A sharp pain rippled across her midsection, and for a moment she was gripped by terrible panic. Is it a miscarriage? Am I going to have a miscarriage? But the pain left, and the baby kicked again, more strongly than before. She went back into the living room, carrying an axe that now smelled like tripe. His legs had somehow managed to stand. "Jack, I loved you so much," she said, "but this isn't you." She brought the axe down in a whistling arc that split him at the pelvis, sliced the carpet, and drove deep into the solid oak floor beneath. The legs separated, trembled wildly for almost 5 minutes, and then began to grow quiet. At last, even the toes stopped twitching. She carried him down to the cellar piece by piece, wearing her oven gloves and wrapping each piece with the insulating blankets Jack had kept in the shed and which she had never thrown away. He and the crew threw them over the pots on cold days so the lobsters wouldn't freeze. Once a severed hand closed upon her wrist. She stood still and waited, her heart drumming heavily in her chest, and at last it loosened again. And that was the end of it, the end of him. There was an unused cistern, polluted, below the house. Jack had been meaning to fill it in. Maddie slid the heavy concrete cover aside so that its shadow lay on the earthen floor like a partial eclipse, and then threw the pieces of him down, listening to the splashes. When everything was gone, she worked the heavy cover back into place. Rest in peace, she whispered, and an interior voice whispered back that her husband was resting in pieces. And then she began to cry, and her cries turned to hysterical shrieks, and she pulled at her hair and tore at her breasts until they were bloody, and she thought, I am insane. This is what it is like to be insane. But before the thought could be completed, she had fallen down in a faint, and the faint became a deep sleep, and the next morning she felt all right. She would never tell, though. Never. I can bear it, she told Dave Emmons again, thrusting aside the image of the knitting needle with the booty swinging from the end of it, jutting out of the kelp-slimed eye socket of the thing which had once been her husband and co-creator of the child in her womb. Really? So he told her, perhaps because he had to tell someone or go mad, but he glossed over the worst parts. He told her that they had chainsawed the corpses that absolutely refused to return to the land of the dead, but he did not tell her that some of the parts had continued to squirm, hands with no arms attached to them clutching mindlessly, feet divorced from their legs, digging at the bullet-chewed earth of the graveyard as if trying to run away, and that these parts had been doused with diesel fuel and set afire. Maddie did not have to be told this part. She had seen the pyre from the house. Later, Genesee Island's one fire truck had turned its hose on the dying blaze, although there wasn't much chance of the fire spreading, with a brisk easterly blowing the sparks off Jenny's seaward edge. When there was nothing left but a stinking, tallowy lump, and still there were occasional bulges in this mass, like twitches in a tired muscle, Matt Arsenault fired up his old D9 Caterpillar. Above the nicked steel blade and under his faded Pelotic engineer's cap, Matt's face had been as white as cottage cheese, and plowed the whole hellacious mess under. The moon was coming up when Frank took Bob Daggett, Dave Emmons, and Cal Partridge aside. It was Dave he spoke to. I knew it was coming, and here it is, he said. What are you talking about, Unc? Bob asked. My hat, Frank said. Goddamn thing's thrown a rod. Now, Uncle Frank. Never mind Uncle Frank this and Uncle Frank that, the old man said. I ain't got time to listen to you play fiddledy-fuck on the mouth organ. Seen half my friends go the same way. It ain't no day at the races, but it could be worse. Beats hell out of getting whacked with a cancer stick. But now, there's this other sorry business to mind, and all I got to say on that subject is when I go down, I intend to stay down. Cal, stick that rifle of yours in my left ear. Dave, when I raise my left arm, you sock yours into my armpit, and Bobby, you put yours right over my heart. I'm going to say the Lord's Prayer, and when I hit Amen, you three fellas are going to pull your triggers at the same time. Uncle Frank, Bob managed. He was reeling on his heels. I told you not to start in on that, Frank said, and don't you dare faint on me, you friggin' panty waste. Now get your country butt over here. Bob did. Frank looked around at the three men, their faces as white as Matt Arsenault's had been when he drove the dozer over men and women he had known since he was a kid in short pants and Buster Browns. Don't you boys frig this up, Frank said. He was speaking to all of them, but his eye might have been particularly trained on his grandnephew. If you feel like maybe you're going to backslide, just remember, I'd have done the same for any of you. Quit with the speech, Bob said hoarsely. I love you, Uncle Frank. You ain't the man your father was, Bobby Daggett, but I love you too, Frank said calmly. And then, with a cry of pain, he threw his left hand up over his head like a guy in New York who has to have a cab in a rip of a hurry and started in with his last prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, Christ, that hurts! Hallowed be thy name, O son of a gun! Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it... Frank's upraised left arm was wavering wildly now. Dave Emmons, with his rifle socked into the old geezer's armpit, watched it as carefully as a logger would watch a big tree that looked like it meant to do evil and fall the wrong way. Every man on the island was watching now. Big beads of sweat had formed on the old man's pallid face. His lips had pulled back from the even yellowy white of his roebuckers, and Dave had been able to smell the pollen on his breath. As it is in heaven, the old man jerked out. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Oh shit, forever and ever, amen. All three of them fired, and both Cal Partridge and Bob Daggett fainted, but Frank never did try to get up and walk. Frank Daggett had meant to stay dead, and that was just what he did. Once Dave started that story, he had to go on with it, and so he cursed himself for ever starting. He had been right the first time. It was no story for a pregnant woman. But Maddie had kissed him and told him she thought he had done wonderfully and that Frank Daggett had done wonderfully, too. Dave went out feeling a little dazed, as if he had just been kissed on the cheek by a woman he had never met before. In a very real sense, that was true. She watched him go down the path to the dirt track that was one of Jenny's two roads and turn left. He was weaving a little in the moonlight, weaving with tiredness, she thought, but reeling with shock as well. Her heart went out to him, to all of them. She had wanted to tell Dave she loved him and kiss him squarely on the mouth instead of just skimming his cheek with her lips, but he might have taken the wrong meaning from something like that, even though he was bone-weary and she was almost 5 months pregnant. But she did love him, loved all of them, because they had gone through hell in order to make this little lick of land 40 miles out in the Atlantic safe for her. And safe for her baby. "It will be a home delivery," she said softly as Dave went out of sight behind the dark hulk of the Pulsifer satellite dish. Her eyes rose to the moon. "It will be a home delivery, and it will be fine."
This has been a presentation of Penguin Highbridge Audio.